I'm Mary, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
And I'm powerless over alcohol and drugs, and my life is still unmanageable today. And I've been here since I got sober in 1980. I got clean in 1982. And right before I came here, I lost my keys, and then my dog ran away outside the front door. Luckily, he's been nice to me recently, so I managed to catch him fairly quickly. So I made it here just a little bit late. But it was kind of symptomatic of how life goes, and you just can't control it. And I spent a lot of time trying to control it. I spent a lot of time trying to control or not even experience my feelings when I was drinking and using. I don't really want to talk about my drunk log because there's not very much time, but suffice it to say, I'm just kind of a garden variety drunk who experienced a lot of abandonment and living with other families and going to a whole bunch of different high schools and started using drugs so I didn't have to be like my mother, who was a steady, ladylike, wine-drinking alcoholic who started at noon and who would drink until basically she passed out. And she couldn't remember anything I told her, but she never really caused any problems. I mean, she could be kind of cold and viciously critical when she was drinking, but honestly, I was like, fuck that, I'm out, I'm going, you know, and I was taking acid and eating speed and smoking a lot of weed, and, you know, I went off to Colorado to school for the last couple of years of high school, and then I went to France to work in a hotel, and I came and I went to Cal. So I came up here in the 70s when total strangers would walk up to you on the street and hand you a joint. And so that it was fine for my drug use. But then I started throwing alcohol back in the mix. And I had drank in high school, and I didn't remember until after I got sober that I was blacking out. I was drinking with the college kids at the beach and downing whole bottles of wine and going body surfing naked and just never. I had no curb. I had no stop. You know, I just kept going. And but I had, you know, it was kind of fun, and I had some other things going on in my life in those early days. And then my dad died when I was 24, and I got a lot of responsibility. He was an artist, so I was dealing with his art. And I started, I remember, I just wrote a piece, and it's called The Liquor Cabinet. And the first thing I did, I climbed in an upstairs window to the house. The cops were there right away. They knew that address because he had committed suicide. And they let me stay, but I just went right for the liquor cabinet. And there was bottles and bottles of scotch and all kinds of other stuff in there. And it went on like that all through my 20s. And I added cocaine in there, and that got me drinking more and staying up and drinking more. And I started doing a lot of stuff that I was ashamed of. I was very promiscuous. I was unkind to other people. I was ruled by my desires and whatever I thought I wanted, and I didn't give a shit about anybody else. I mean, I thought I did. I lived with someone that I cared about, but I still couldn't control my urges. And I started realizing, I started having this feeling like I was going to die very shortly. I was getting into fights in bars. I was driving blacked out. I was taking other people's cars. I was hanging out in pool halls where I shouldn't have been. And I got to the point where I started to become my mom. I was drinking at home alone again. And then I was told I was going to be left and I tried, I went to a few AA meetings, and I actually heard that it was a disease, because I blamed myself. I thought it was my fault, I should be able to control myself, all this other stuff, and that was not the case. I do believe that it is a disease, that we have a physical allergy to alcohol. I mean, someone just explained it to me, said, you crossed a line, you know, you no longer can drink like a normal person. And I hadn't for quite a while, but I actually believed them. And I also, you know, didn't know what to do. And this person told me, you can go back out and try to do some controlled drinking, but if you are an alcoholic, you're going to be back doing the same things within a pretty short time, I would imagine. And alcoholism is a disease that only gets worse, you know. And the shakes were already bad, the projectile vomiting, all that kind of stuff. I'm happy to say I've only gotten sick to my stomach once since I got sober, and that was with the Mexican revenge or something. But, you know, I've had to let go of just thinking that alcohol or drugs will ever do anything for me. I mean, I've had to have surgery and sobriety, and I've had to take strong narcotics for knee replacements and stuff like that. But I'm really cautious about it. I tell somebody when I'm taking them. I try to taper off them as quick as I can. I don't really like feeling different anymore, you know. So what's going on right now is that, you know, I've gone through different stages of my life, and now I'm... Both my kids are alcoholics and addicts. I went through a kind of extremely humiliating divorce about 9 years ago. My husband left me for a young lady in the program who was 25 years younger, and it was difficult. And there's some people here who knew me then, and who were there for me on the day he got married, and my kids were with him, and many of our friends were with him. And I had to come to a realization that, you know, my identity doesn't lie in the roles that I play in my life. And right now, I have one kid that's having a hard time, and she gets sober and then, or gets clean and then relapses, and I got pretty strong in Al-Anon, and I went through all the steps in Al-Anon, and it's not easy still, but I made a decision that I was going to do something for myself that I really wanted to do, and I sold the house that they lived in as teenagers. It wasn't a particularly happy house, and I am buying a house in Santa Cruz right now because I love the ocean. I have really close friends down there. From my childhood, and there's some work I think I might be able to do better down there. So I'm making a big change, and I have to, like, say it's okay. You know, I'm willing to take risks. I'm willing to kind of follow my heart at this point in time, and I wake up in the mornings and I go, oh shit, I'm making a big mistake. All my friends are here. What am I going to do? You know, but I've been to meetings down there. I've been to meditation down there. I know that I'm a fairly adaptable person. And so I'm hoping it's going to work out. And I'm not selling my house in Oakland just in case. I'm coming back. All right. Thank you.
My name is John. I am an alcoholic. John. And when we come to meetings and we hear our speakers say things like, oh, I'm so grateful to be asked to share, sometimes it just sounds like words. but I am really grateful to be asked to share. This is the first time I've shared for longer than 10 or 15 minutes, so get ready. I am not humble, and I think I need to say that. And I have sort of an uninteresting story. I have really interesting stories about my bottom and all of that good stuff. And I just won't get ahead of myself here. Anyway, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah in 1962. And I was born into a very Mormon family. My ancestry is... My ancestors actually were the pioneers that came in and settled the Salt Lake Valley in the state of Utah, as it turns out. So it goes very deeply back into my family roots, so we're all Mormon. I'm still technically a Mormon, although the day I moved out of my parents' house, I never went back to church. So conservative family, conservative community, Salt Lake City, Utah. I am the third of four children. There's two boys, two girls, very orderly. My parents were that. I wouldn't say that the house was chaotic. We always knew we were secure. We had food, we had shelter, we had clothes. It was a very, you know, middle-class upbringing. My dad was very difficult. My mother's always been the rock of our family, has always been. She's just a really terrific lady. My self-esteem took hits practically from the very beginning. We were all adored, lovely, we were adorable children, of course. But I am the third, the middle one, and it was pretty clear early on that I was going to walk on the side of the homos, because I liked my mommy's high-heeled shoes, my sister's skirts, Barbie dolls, all of it. Julie Andrews, come on. They should have known. And a little sensitive, and I liked pretty things, and you know, and I one of my best earliest memories of my mom. I was 4 years old. She was pregnant with my younger sister, and my grandparents took us to lunch every year for our birthdays. My birthday's the 4th of July. My grandma always told me the fireworks were for me, and I believed her. Lack of humility. Anyway, so they take us out for lunch and a gift. And when they took me to the toy store, I pointed to a white-haired swirl ponytail Barbie with bubblegum lips. And the clerk at the toy store kept pulling out G.I. Joes, and I'm like, no, I want her. And they bought her for me. So one of my earliest memories is my mom had made me a shirt, 4th of July, red, white, and blue, little red ship's wheels and blue anchors on a white shirt, and she made my Barbie a matching dress. And she was, I was sitting underneath her sewing machine, and she said, and honey, this is the bodice. And then she would show me the skirt, and she attached it all together, and she sewed snaps on it, and I had a matching dress or shirt to my Barbie. It was sweet. And of course, they hoped that I was gonna grow out of that. That did not happen, and in fact, my storage unit is full of probably about 1,100 Barbies in the box. And there, we're gonna talk about that in a little bit. Just is. So, my brother and sisters, growing up, I was definitely the gay kid. They all had names for me. My dad's name for me growing up was Sally Ann. It was not done out of affection. My brother's was Fottle, Fruit of the Loom. My older sister was Femiron Tablet, because that was seemed to be the thing Phyllis Newman was advertising on TV in those days. And my little sister just was a scratcher. So I just had scratches all over me all the time. This sounds like I was an abused child. Kind of, yeah, but not really. I mean, it was siblings fight. And I got a few punches in, so we're all good. But going out into the real world, to school, to church, we had church every week, was always a problem. And I was somewhat of a target, and I kind of asked for it in a naive way. I mean, we never know that we're all that different. I just thought I was okay. And so I did not like school, and I'm not dumb, but I did not, and I also was not very focused. It was very easy for me to be distracted. I think there's a pill for that these days, but we didn't have that in 1967, so I just had to go to school and do the best that I could. But school was a punishing experience from elementary through junior high. I add to that I was probably 25 pounds overweight and, you know, this tall. Didn't help. My brother and sisters used to stick their fingers in my belly button to see how many knuckles would disappear. So,
yeah.
You can't get even one knuckle now, okay? It's all good. Anyway, so that was kind of the life. So the self-esteem was not in place. And so I just kind of walked through school with my head down and just dodging bullets and hoping nobody would notice me that day. And then I would go home and I would play with my sister's Barbies downstairs in the basement, or I started sewing when I was in seventh grade because I got bored in Utah history class. Come on, give me a break, who wouldn't? And I just started thinking of all these things I was going to make on the sewing machine, and yet it turned out to be Barbie clothes because I still had Barbies and that I bought myself with babysitting money. And I started sewing, which has served me well in my lifetime, so I make no apologies for that. Actually, I'm starting to learn not to make a lot of apologies for things that I just am. Round about my sophomore year in high school, I grew 8 inches over the summer and lost that 25 pounds, and I went back to school practically a new human being, and nobody noticed until my senior year when the girls started noticing, and then I got asked to all the girls' choice dances, which was great. Just because, you know, a little bit of a self-esteem boost. And then I was talking about this a little earlier with my friends at dinner. When I was about 15, the Utah Opera Company was formed, and our assistant choral conductor was the choral conductor for the opera company, and so she came into the boys' glee and the girls' glee and said, oh, we need someone to come in and sing choral children's parts for the opera La Boheme. It opened up a whole new world for me. I was out of church because we did that every Sunday. I knew all of the players that are in our church. But this was a new group of people. They weren't all Mormon, and they were really nice. They liked me. They didn't make fun of me. They thought I was a nice kid and bubbly and cute. In fact, somebody actually signed my opera program, Stay Cute and Bubbly. I did. And it just opened up a whole new world for me. That I wasn't that much of an outcast, that I wasn't that weird. It was fine. About this time, 16, I had my first glass of champagne. I drank half of it. It made me sick, and I never went back until the next year. When I was 17, and the Manhattan Transfer was singing the song called Scotch and Soda, and I was at an adult's house, and they offered me a scotch and soda, and I thought, well, look at me, aren't I grown up? I couldn't drink it. I mean, scotch was terrible. I got over that in later years. Alcohol was not a big part of our growing up. It just, Mormons don't drink, they don't have coffee. Cheers to them. My group of friends in high school changed, and I still went to church, but all of the boys that, you know, I did Boy Scouts, I played on the church basketball team, and by the way, the church basketball team, I went to practice every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, and I got to play exactly 3 minutes in the game in the last quarter after our team had won. Mm-hmm. Because they just had to kind of throw me in there because there I was. And yet I did all the Boy Scout things. I backpacked, I fished, I camped. And I did it better than most of them just because that's what we grew up doing. And Jeff Vincent was sort of my nemesis. Oh, we're not supposed to use last names here, but you don't know him, so I'm going to use it anyway. He was the good-looking one, and he was the one that all the girls liked, and he thought he was so slick. And when his he got this new camping utensil. It was the knife, the fork, and the spoon that all locked together, and it was in a nice little vinyl pouch. And the older scouts, this one particular trip, shook him over the fire. They lifted him up and threw him over the fire, and his precious vinyl pouch got melted in the fire, and he went into his tent and cried. Ha! I didn't ever do that. And that very same trip, though, I was initiated into the Boy Scouts by, all of a sudden, it was like, initiation! And they all jumped me, they pulled my pants down, they sapped my ass with pine sap they'd been collecting all week, and then they took all the pine needles and soot and everything like that and rubbed that into my backside. That was my initiation. That was 3 hours of scrubbing with cold water, wash rag, and some soap. That was not very nice, but it was okay. Par for the course, that's kind of how things happened when I was growing up. I just remembered that. Isn't it funny, when you have 40 minutes to talk, you can just talk about anything. Stream of consciousness, we're going for it. So I've now started developing this group of outside friends, which included an older gentleman, 38. And in those days, that was older, especially when you're 17. And he would be the gentleman that would eventually help me acknowledge the fact that I was gay. He actually put a name to it and told me I wasn't the only one. I didn't ever really think I was the only one, because certainly somebody else had to feel the same way that I did. That was my logic. And I kind of never looked back. I never felt bad about it. I did not come out to my family. I didn't really need to. However, we just never talked about it. It was one of those situations where everything got swept under the rug. We just played like everything was fine. Oh, my dad was the bishop of our church congregation for a number of years. And I know what my dad was like at home. He was difficult. He could be very mean. We rarely got smacked. We were not physically accosted. Maybe spanked every once in a while, but nothing. But his verbal attacks were the problem. And my mother suffered it the worst. And she was very. She is a tiger mom. She will not let anyone touch her kids. And in fact, growing up, she always would tell the worst thing that could happen to her would be as if she had to bury one of her children. More later on that one. So she was, again, the stalwart. She started working full time when I was in first grade. My dad always made sure that, he always had a job, but his job changes were fairly frequent through the course of our growing up years. So again, I never really felt like we were in peril, but sometimes when he was out of work, the family would pay the price emotionally because of that. I started finding my own group of friends even in high school, and we had a great time and did all of that stuff. And when I was 17, Christmas vacation was the time that I lost my virginity. And this was what happened. I kind of knew it was going to happen. It was to a man. And he was very kind. It was this man that I met doing the operas, and we remained friends for years afterwards. I didn't feel in any way compromised. But this is what I did, because we had heard all the time growing up, oh, you will never cleanse yourself of those sins if you did something outside of the marriage bond, outside, you know, certainly being gay was not going to fly. I went home. It was about 10:30 at night. I drew a bath, and I just sat, and I laid in the bath, and my thought was this: thank God that's over, because it was an acknowledgement. I was 17 years old, and there was a little God shot looking back, because I never felt even the first hint of shame over it. I knew who I was. It put a word, and it put something to who I was as a human being. And I got out of that tub and I went to sleep, and I've been fine with that part of me ever since. It's not really been much of an issue. And I will also say that there has always been, through the course of my life, these little moments, these little tiny spiritual quiet moments that only you're going to feel driving a car at 10:30 at night. It's freezing degrees outside, and I'm feeling, you know, tense about something, And all of a sudden, this moment of peace will fall over me and say, you're fine. Everything's fine. And there have been a few of those moments through the course of my life, even in the depths of my alcoholism. So we'll just kind of fast forward. I graduate high school. I start working at a bank. And I put myself through college. I went to LDS Business College in fashion merchandising and interior design. Again, why is anyone surprised? And round about my 21st birthday, because 21 is the drinking age in Salt Lake City, my friends Troy and Michael and I decided to go out to a bar. We are now old enough to go to a bar. And my little sister had her very special, that mom and dad bought her car. The rest of us had to buy our own cars. They bought her a 67 Plymouth Satellite, B-52s, remember that? So Michael and Troy and I, Michael, we need to remember that name because he plays an important part in my life. Michael and Troy and I all decided we were going to go down to the only known homosexual establishment in Salt Lake City, Utah, and take me out for my birthday. And I told mom something else, and I was house sitting for Missy Burton's parents. So I kind of had a free pass. I did not have to report home. Just mom thought I was going to be going back to Missy Burton's parents' house. So we drove down, we danced, we had a great time, and then I got home the next day. And my little sister, unbeknownst to me, had decided that she was going to get in her car and follow us to where we were really going to go. So I get home the next day, mom and I are downstairs at our respecting sewing tables, by the way. She's at her machine, and by now I've bought my own. And I'm making money, so it's okay. Everyone's good. If it's a making money proposition, it's okay if you're a boy that sews. But if you're a boy that just sews his own shirts, then that's not good. And I made some smart-ass remark to my little sister, and she says, if you don't watch it, John, I'm going to tell mom where you really went last night. Big deal. So she storms upstairs, and then my mom, being a mom, walks upstairs after her, and she comes down the stairs about 10 minutes later. She sits at her chair. John, where did you really go last night? Well, if Shelley wants to tell you, Shelley's going to tell you. Pause. John, the sun, do you know what kind of a place that is? Yes, Mom, I know exactly what kind of a place that is. And that was my coming out story to my mother. We talked about it for about a week. We drove to work every day together and back because we worked in the same building. And she was really struggling with it, but only from this her religious, spiritual aspect. That was her struggle. She loved me. I am her son. She was trying to reconcile my eternal salvation, as she believes, to what my eternal salvation is going to look like. We decided at that time not to tell my father, because my dad's is difficult. Well, so the Mormon Church decided to take things in their own hands about a year later, and the Elders Quorum Presidency had heard my name. The president of the Elders Quorum Presidency was a close family friend. He worked at a company where two of the members of the Salt Lake Men's Choir worked, and we were all, the Men's Choir, we were a social group too. And he'd heard my name brought up one too many times between the two of these guys, and so he put two and two together, and they got the Elders Quorum Presidency together, and they decided to go up to my dad on a May night when he is mowing the lawn, and I'm on a date with Jeff Wood by now. That didn't go anywhere, but I was on a date with Jeff Wood, and the only reason why that's significant is because he was the one I was on a date with when the Elders Quorum Presidency went up to my dad and asked him what they could do to help him with my problem, which he said, what problem? They told him. He's humiliated because his pride is huge. And he goes into my mother, and she reveals that she's known for the better part of a year, which was the worst decision we could have made. So he didn't talk to her for 2 months. He did not sleep in the same bed with her for 2 months. Silent treatment. And I'd walk into a room, he'd walk out. Because I was still living at home at that point. So I decided maybe it was time for me to, like, skedaddle. And I'm 21, so it's time to, you know, fly the coop. So I did. And the day that I left, we've never talked about it. The day that I moved out, he left a pamphlet written by Spencer W. Kimball, who was the president of the Mormon Church at the time, with a sticky note that said, "John, let's talk sometime." Because that was my dad. I am the father. We're going to talk sometime. Moved out, we never talked about it since. We made the same mistake several years later when I was diagnosed with HIV. So anyway, my drinking career up at this point was not remarkable. I think I got drunk 5 times that I could count on my hand before I was 30. I was not a big drinker, and I didn't keep alcohol in my house, and I think I kept a bottle of scotch once for over a month. All of us know that that is not possible when you're an alcoholic. So I moved to Southern California in 1989. I'm diagnosed with HIV in 1990. My friend Michael, who by now we met when we were 19, I am now 29, so 10 years later, he was the first person I called, and I just said, "Michael, I have something to tell you." 10 minutes of no, not a word. We just sat on the phone. And then I called my mom. We decided not to tell my dad. History repeats itself. And it did not make me drink. I did not drink over that. And this was another God shot. I got tested in the days when it was all anonymous, you were a number. And the man that gave me my diagnosis was a doctor from Salt Lake City, Utah, that I had socialized with in the previous 10 years. And we just ended up at that place at that time. And again, the little, you know, the small hand of God, and I say God as a referential term. Our higher powers are our higher powers. It's an individual thing, but it's one syllable. It's easy to refer to, so it doesn't necessarily mean a male sky daddy that's, you know, watching over all of us and pointing his fingers. So I moved to San Francisco. Now I'm starting to live, I was going to say the high life, but in this group, probably not a good idea. I experimented with, I did a little meth, I did a little ecstasy, I did some cocaine. I never really liked weed, dropped acid, and that's the extent of my drug career. And it was maybe over the space of 3 years, and it was literally 3 or 4 times a year when we'd all go take our shirts off and dance at the disco with my long hair flying and my work boots and Daisy Dukes. It was not a good look, but, you know, I thought I was rocking it, and it was all good, you know. And in those days, I had the hair I could do that with, but not anymore. And it was fun. I'm not going to lie, we had a good time. Still wasn't, drugs never really started to hit me. I would say round about 35 is when there was enough money coming in, I could keep alcohol in the house all the time. Social life was firmly in place in San Francisco, and so it became a daily thing. Then I met the man that I would eventually buy a house with and live with, because I've never, you know, there are boyfriends along the way, but, you know. Nothing stuck. He stuck for a while. And we started drinking every day. We did a lot of house renovations, which kind of kept us together, surprisingly. And then we got everything settled. And then it just, obviously, the relationship wasn't very solid, because he would come home from work and he'd take his cigarettes and his wine and his phone out into the backyard, where he would now be on the phone for 2 or 3 hours with all of his girlfriends, and they would talk and blah, 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 and I'd take care of the dogs. Grace and Molly, we need to talk about them too. We take care of the dogs. I'd go to the gym, take care of the dogs, I'd come home and cook, because I can cook. And he didn't ever want to go out to eat, because why would we go out to eat when we have this food at home? And, like, okay, I didn't realize he was cheap. Just kidding. And I made them, and I would be in the house drinking. So by the time dinner got on the table, it was 9 o'clock. Because why rush? And we're both half in the bag, and so no happy conversations were happening at that point at dinner time. So a little sniping started happening, and not really good relations. And then we decided to sell the house because we owned it. We owned a 2-flat building in common, tenancy in common with his former partner, which I should have seen that red flag, but love and lots of vodka just blurs your vision. So we sold the house and moved to Oakland, where we then, my best friend Michael, had come to see me in September. Michael, when we were 25, was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And so I had seen him go in and out of a lot of his manic depressive disorders. And he had come in September to visit. We had a really nice time. David was traveling, so we just had a few solid days together. Went to see Eddie Izzard. We went all over the city and had a good time. And he was put on a new medication because he was very diligent about his mental health. And he went to get his master's in business and after his diagnosis. And he was living in Las Vegas, had a really nice career. And so we had that time together. And then in October, we always talked on Saturday mornings. We had our coffee talk. Wow, it's already 10 minutes. I see, I told you. You know, give me a minute and I'm going to take it. So I'll quickly fast forward through this. But anyway, I talked with Michael on a Saturday morning in October. And the next call I got was his mother that Monday, the following Monday. And Michael had committed suicide that day. My first significant loss as an adult of a contemporary, and it just happened to me, my best friend. Mm-hmm. And I drank, you know, and by that time, our conversation on that Saturday was, yeah, David and I are selling the house and things are trouble and bitch, bitch, bitch. And I said, like, I've been really hitting the vodka lately. And he's just like, yeah, well, what are you going to do? Then I quit my job. I worked I'm an interior designer, and I worked for a really good designer in the city. And so David and I decided it was okay for me to quit my job and start my own business. And then he leaves me. We sell our house and we move to Oakland, and then he breaks up with me, which is also a bad thing because no one ever breaks up with me. I break up with them. That was the ultimate in the self-esteem. That was it. That was the end of it. Drink. 2 years, went through the proceeds of the sale of the house because God knows I wasn't managing a business very well, had my dogs, and I ran out of money. And on Memorial Day, which will be 2006, so 14 years ago, I am packing up my house and all the last bits and bobs of my Barbie collection in a couple of, which is huge, by the way, but now there's the Play Barbie Village packed up in shoe boxes that I loaded into the car. I loaded my dogs, Grace and Wally, into the car, and I'm in Oakland, and I'm moving back into San Francisco to a friend's basement, and I've been drinking all day long, just vodka cranberries all day long. And it was 7 o'clock at night on that Monday, where I am driving onto the approach of the Bay Bridge, and I overcorrected a turn, slammed on the brakes, the car skidded sideways and flipped twice, landed on the tires, thank God. And my first reaction, thank God my mom always taught us to put our seatbelts on, or else this conversation would not be happening. The car landed, and I'm like, did anyone see? And then I tried to start the car. I remember this vividly, and of course the car's totaled, so that all the glass in this Honda Element is gone. Grace bolted from the scene of the accident while he was still in the car, and the police came and did their thing, and they took Wally to SPCA. I had no idea where Grace was. My blood alcohol content was 0.42 when we started, they took me to the hospital because by that point I was bleeding and cuts and nothing terrible. Spent the night in jail, walked home. By this time I'm like 17 hours without alcohol, so the shakes are really set in. So I stopped by the liquor store, picked up a pint, got back to my apartment, and I was moving that particular day. The movers were coming to take all my stuff away, and well, I missed that appointment. And I got in the shower after I'd had a couple of belts to kind of settle everything down, and then I pass out in the shower and I wake up and it split my eye and had a nice big bruise on it. So this terrific bruise from the seatbelt and the armor, it was great. And then we went and picked up my dogs because there was a phone call from the Oakland SPCA saying that Grace and Wally were ready to come home. So somebody picked up Grace somehow and got her to the SPCA, so she survived that. That did not get me to stop drinking. I continued to drink after that. I went to rehab. Linda and Scott don't know this, but I'm just coming full. We drank in rehab. My rehab did not work. So I lied for a couple of years after that, took commitments in AA meetings. I was, you know, and don't lie, it catches up with you. And so in May of 2010, I was walking up, I was living in yet another place, and I was walking up the stairs in the outer mission, into the house, and I walked into the kitchen. There was nothing for me to, nothing to trip on. No, nothing to slip on, nothing. My feet went right out from under me. I was not going to catch any traction at all. Bam, my head hit the floor, hit this side, and I laid there, and it stunned me enough that I shit my pants, and I'm just laying there on the floor for a few minutes, and I'm going, wow, that was weird. I get up, and I clean up, and I go to the liquor store. By the way, the only time I've ever wakened up early is going to the liquor store at 7 o'clock in the morning, so I could get my fix to, you know, get me through the day, and I wasn't working at that point. I have 5 minutes. That landed me in the San Francisco General Lockdown Police Ward because I had brain seizures 2 weeks later on the street walking my dogs. They took my dogs away from me. I never saw them again. My former partner, David, readopted Grace. Wally was put down by the city of San Francisco because he killed a dog while I was seizuring on the street. So that is where we are. That landed me in sober living, where I lived for 4 years. I ended up managing sober living, thank God. It was a really brilliant experience. It kept me sober when I didn't know that I don't know that I would have had the wherewithal to stay sober. But it got me sober. July 29th, I spent about 6 weeks in the hospital 2 different times that summer. And when I walked out of the hospital on July, while I was in the hospital the second time, and I'm waiting at 3:35 in the morning for the nurse to come in and give me my next shot, because the second seizure I had, I broke my shoulder, because anyway, I was laying in this big hospital room. It was about this big, and I was one of two people in it, and I just laid there, and it was that little voice that we all get to hear once in a while that said, I don't want to die. And that voice had not been speaking for a really long time. She came in and gave me my shot. I walked out of the hospital on July 29th, 2010. I have been continuously sober since then. 4 years of sobriety. I moved into my very first adult, grown-up, sober apartment. Now I'm going to cry, and my friends are going to laugh at me because I told them I never cry. My dad died last year. I have been to Salt Lake City now. By the end of this month, I will be there 5 times since December because it was the year first without my father. We get to help my mom claim a house. She's never lived alone in her 80 years, and she gets this house all to herself. I'm involved in my nieces and nephews' lives in a very significant way. I'm helping them plan weddings, decorate their apartments, and help them cook. The gifts are insanely beautiful because they're the quiet little gifts that we get every day. The friends that I have made, in this program are the best friends. And the friends that I had before that kind of went away when I was in the depth of my alcoholism, the significant ones are back, and the friendships are strong, and I can be present for them. My friend Linda will be 4 years ago in November, kept sending me all these websites to dog adoption agencies. One morning in November, there was Lily. Oh. Lily looks just like Wally, but half the size. She was born blind. And this was the biggest gotcha of them all. Because she's just this... I know she's a dog. I know. But it's a sobriety gift. And it was a gift that I just could not imagine having. She is just that little bit every day of God's love shining down. I get to take care of her every day. She is perfect. I've kept a tree alive for 5 years now. I've kept my dog alive for nearly 4 years now. I think I'm a grown-up. And I think I am a sober grown-up. And God willing, the 29th of this month, I will be 9 years continuously sober, and I'll get to celebrate that with my mom at her home. So, of course, I said nothing about what I was going to say because I had this whole thought written out. It's not going to happen quickly. Humility. Today's daily reflection. Humility is a gift. As long as we placed self-reliance first, a genuine reliance upon a higher power was out of the question. That basic ingredient of all humanity, a desire to seek and do God's will, was missing. When I first came to AA, I wanted to find some of the elusive quality called humility. I didn't realize I was looking for humility because I thought it would help me get what I wanted, and that I would do anything for others if I thought God would somehow reward me for it. I try to remember now that the people I meet in the course of my day are as close to God as I am ever going to get while on this earth. I need to pray for knowledge of God's will today and see how my experience with hope and pain can help other people. If I can do that, I don't need to search for humility. It has found me. Thank you.